You're listening to the Common Descent Podcast.
Hello, Will.
Hello, David.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Common Descent Podcast. This is Silver Screen Science. We're talking about Meg 2. If your new Silver Screen Science is a side series that we do from time to time where we talk about the science of movies. Specifically, we look at movies, usually ones in our general wheelhouse of paleontology and environments and stuff like that. And we take a look at the way science and scientific topics are represented in the films, not just nitpicking what they got right or wrong, but exploring how science is represented. How does this film fit into the intersection of science and pop culture? This year, we're releasing a batch of Silver Screen Science episodes in this month of April on a theme. The Meg 2 came out last year. We did the Meg 1 a few years ago. Figured we'd do the sequel, and while we're doing Meg 2, might as well do some shark movies.
Good excuse to see some other films with these creatures.
We've been bouncing around the ideas of doing a shark-themed silver screen batch for a while. This seems like the time to do it. So we'll be going through the movie, talking about how the creatures and some of the science-y stuff in there is shown, and we'll spend a little bit of extra time talking about sharks and yes. How sharks are generally treated in movies and how this movie does on that regard. Spoilers, not very good. The movie in question is Meg 2, The Trench, released last year, 2023, a sequel to The Meg from 2018. This movie directed by Ben Wheatley. From this point on, this is your official spoiler warning.
Yes.
We will be discussing everything we think to discuss about the movie. We're going to be talking a bunch about the later scenes of this movie.
Yeah, a bunch of stuff to discuss at the end.
Yes, Act 3, we're going to be talking a whole bunch about it. So if you want to watch the movie first, go do that. Come back, listen to this. Will, would you please give us a brief synopsis of Meg 2, The Trench?
Happily. So after the first movie, we find that the world now knows of Megs, and there is one in human care, and there are now regular visits down through the thermocline, that layer of cold water that protects the trench habitat, the ancient trench habitat down at the bottom of the sea. On one of those routine visits, the Meg in their care gets out, follows them down there for a Meg mating ritual.
Yep.
And then a tussle with some rogue miners that are digging up rare earth metals, I think is what they said it was.
Yeah, I think so.
Causes an explosion that releases those sharks as well as some other creatures. They fight with the bad guys, and then they have to fight with all the animals that attack a party resort island nearby.
Yes, if you saw the first movie, the part where the shark gets out and then goes to the big party resort island, that happens again.
Yes.
It's the same thing. There's even a alternate language version of a popular song from the 90s, I guess. Again, like in the last movie.
Honestly,
it was one of my favorite parts of the last movie.
Yep. A little dog gets in the water and gets out.
And the little dog, too.
Then it ends once all the big creatures are dead.
Once all the bad guys and the monsters are dead.
Yep.
Then that's the end of the movie. So in this movie, most of the science-y stuff that there is to talk about is creatures and settings.
Yeah.
Let's start with the creatures. There are a few prominent creatures. We'll highlight three, really the three big ones.
Yes.
In the movie, these will be the megalodons.
Mm-hmm.
The weird amphibious creatures from the Cretaceous.
Yeah.
We'll get onto those later on. And the Kraken.
Yep.
I suppose. There's a giant octopus.
Yes.
that also comes out of the trench and attacks a bunch of people. There's also a couple of scenes that show other creatures, and we can talk about those as well. But let's start with the headliner. Not only the headliner of the movie, but the headliner of our Silver Screen Science series this year, the sharks.
The big ol' sharks.
The Megs in question are megalodons. Megalodon, of course, is a real-life shark. that lived throughout the Cenozoic era, the biggest sharks known to have ever lived, growing up to sizes of 30, 40 feet long. Preposterously large sharks. Definitely extinct. Definitely not 80 feet long.
Yep.
Like they are in this movie.
Yes.
So there are some obvious artistic licenses with the way that they are portrayed. They are also super monster-y in this movie.
Oh, yeah. Like, just like the last movie, they're too big. They're super aggressive. It's definitely giving the same mentality that a lot of other movies with prehistoric creatures gives of, like, man was never meant to tangle with such beasts.
Yes, and there is a line like that in the movie.
Yeah, where humans were never meant to coexist with Megs or something like that.
Yeah, something like that. So this movie is checking, this has become a refrain here, that monsterization or monsterification. I've heard people say monsterization.
Yeah.
Which is a way cleaner word.
Oh, I like monsterification.
Yeah, I also. Where, if this is your first Silver Screen Science, monsterification is this feature that we talk about that movies like to do, where they will take what should otherwise be a regular animal and give it a bunch of traits that make more sense as a movie monster than as a living creature.
Yeah.
The Megs in this movie are checking all those boxes. They are hyper aggressive, constantly on the hunt for stuff. They bite everything.
Yes.
Except that they don't actually bite everything. They bite whatever the main characters are doing.
Well, and like, it's got very much that video game boss feel of they bite the things that are pre-programmed to be triggers for the Meg in this level of, did you turn the bright lights on? They're gonna bite all the bright lights.
Yes.
Did you turn on the motor here? They're gonna bite that motor. Even though there are tons of scenes where there's extremely similar things going on, and they are ignoring those because that's not what the trigger sequence is for this level of the boss fight.
Well, they're doing that trope that we've talked about in other movies of the monster that has behavior that is triggered by stimulus.
Yes.
That if you make a noise, if you turn on a light, if you get in the water, this monstrous animal will be inexorably drawn to the thing that you're doing, to the source of stimulus.
Makes them very robotic. Makes them very Terminator. Mm-hmm. They are driven to kill, and they have a very select set of sensory cues that they use to follow to their next target.
Yes. They do the blood in the water trope.
Yep.
Which is not exclusive to sharks in movies, but it is very much a classic shark in movies thing.
It's one of the most famous shark facts that gets used for this kind of stuff.
Yes. It's such a famous shark fact that it is a common misconception about sharks.
Yes.
That if there's blood in the water, they will go after it. Which, of course, is not true. There's always blood in the water.
Yeah.
They're surrounded by living things.
And it's that issue of, there's the correct fact that they can detect a very small amount of blood in a very large amount of water.
Yes.
Detection does not tell you what the behavior is going to, what behavior is going to follow that.
Right. In movies, it's commonly shown that they are driven to a frenzy. It is, for all the lovely things that I like about that movie, the Finding Nemo scenario.
Yeah.
Where we see Bruce in Finding Nemo, who smells blood and goes into killer shark mode.
Yes.
Which they do a little bit in this movie. It's signified by the eyes rolling back.
Mm-hmm. To go into attack.
To go into attack mode, I guess, where we see this happen a couple times.
Which is based off of real shark behavior. Sharks cannot blink, at least most sharks. There are some that can just squeeze their face over their eye.
Sure.
Cat sharks and stuff like that can blink effectively by just squishing the skin around their eye. Yeah. They don't have eyelids, but they can just close their face. But most sharks can't blink, so they just roll the pupil back into the eye socket to protect it so that if their eye does get hurt, at least hopefully it's not the front crucial seeing part of the eye.
Right. And my understanding is that they're known to do this when biting things.
Yeah, like right the moment before biting, they roll back so that way if the thing they're biting thrashes or fights back, sure, or whatever, they're protecting the most sensitive part of their face.
Right.
As best they can.
In this movie, there's a couple of moments where the sharks will be charging at something, which they do a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And they do a close-up and the eye rolls back.
Yep.
To signify, I guess, that they're locked on target.
Yes.
Because they're not changing direction, I guess, that they can't see. And there's even a moment where the eye rolls back to normal position to signify that the shark is no longer dangerous.
Yes. Yep. Yep. And like, on one hand, part of the reason sharks can roll their eyes back and still be effective is because they have enough other senses that if they're that close to their prey, they don't need to see it anymore.
Right. Well, and it's also, like you said, the moment of mm-hmm. bite. It's not attack mode.
Yes, it's not they're chasing you down with their eyes rolled back
while
like that.
Biting.
It's while biting. So like, yes, the Meg, while doing that, probably still could detect where you were in the water mm-hmm. with water movement and your electrical senses and their electrical senses, but they're not a torpedo.
Right.
That's how they treat them in this, is that when they go to attack something, they are dozens of feet away from it and they have mouth open, mm-hmm. eyes rolled back, charging at full speed at it because they're going to torpedo ram into it.
Yes. So they are. That's part of that hyper aggression.
Yes.
That we often see in these movies where they're portraying animals as monsters, because that's what you need the monster to do.
Yeah. This is a monster movie, not actually a shark movie.
And on that note, I think it would be interesting to take a little sort of a broader view and talk, since we're going to do a few of these shark movies, talk about how the Meg sharks fit shark portrayal.
Yeah.
How do they fit into the tropes on sort of the spectrum of shark performance in films? How do these fit in?
This one does kind of a weird mixture of things, because they do a bunch of the tropes that are so famous in shark movies of portraying them as these eating machines that are just directed toward any potential food source.
Yes. It's not only did they check the list of monsterification stuff, they also seem to have checked the list of shark tropes in movies. They do the blood in the water thing. They do the fins above the surface, which is a very famous shark movie thing, which in this movie, all the sharks do.
Yes.
That's just how the sharks move, is just below the surface with the fins above the water.
Yep. They do the vibrations, you know, makes you seem like prey and will draw them to you. And
If you get in the
make
water,
you a target.
You turn the engine on, they're going to come and attack that because there's movement, which is also a very common shark trope in movies.
The one thing they did that was at least a little bit of a improvement on shark portrayal in a film is that they do show training. Mm-hmm. Like they suggest that the shark in human care has been trained while it's been there and can respond to signaling.
Yeah.
It's kind of played for not a joke so much to say in the movie, but like everyone else is like, yeah, sure. Right.
Yeah. They leave it ambiguous as to whether or not it actually works or if the dude who thinks it works is just nuts.
Yeah. Cause they also portray it as like, the reason the training works, if it is working, is because of a special emotional bond between the two.
Right.
Which is not accurate, but at least suggesting that you can train a shark and that mm-hmm. sharks are teachable.
Yes.
Is way better than most movies do, because most movies portray them as literally mindless.
Yes. Of cold-blooded killers.
There's barely a brain behind those eyes. But to sense and bite.
Yes. Hence that triggering of mm-hmm. the predatory action kind of thing.
Yeah.
Another thing that they do that is a little bit of a break, showing them as more of an animal. Like you said, there is a relatively minor plot point that the sharks are gathering to mate.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a really interesting, because all the sharks are congregating. But instead of being for some silly monster reason, they're here to mate together.
And they didn't show it, like, super clearly, because it's not, like you said, it's not a focused.
Right. It's kind of in the background of one scene.
But from what I saw, it looked like they had them biting onto each other's fins,
mm-hmm.
which is how a lot of sharks mate. Like, most sharks mate by the male biting onto either the fin or, like, area around the side of the head or gills of the female. And the female often have thickened skin in those areas.
Yeah.
So the male can hang on while they mate, because they mate internally. They have internal fertilization, so they actually have to hold on to each other long enough to finish mating.
Yeah.
So like that was actually kind of neat. Someone watched a video of shark mating for that to animate that scene.
So there is a little bit, there are little hints of sort of less tropey shark stuff. The other place where I think they fall very heavily in shark tropes is that the sharks in this movie are unequivocally monsters.
Yes.
To be destroyed.
Yes.
And that's another thing that commonly comes up in movies like this, is sometimes monster movies will do all the monstery stuff, but then at the end they fall and say, oh, and now we let it go, and now it's, you know, we've parted ways.
Well, it's a lot of them will do the only reason you were a problem is because you were in our world.
Right. Or once, we were in its territory, yes. And we as long as we separate.
Once we get you back to a place where you are meant to be, you will just be an animal again.
Right. This movie, there is never any question that they're just going to kill the sharks.
Yes.
That they are monsters to be destroyed.
As soon as they get out of the trench, it's like, all right, let's start making bomb harpoons.
Yes.
That is step one. Once we're away from the bad guys, let's make some shark killing weapons.
Another trope that comes up specifically with the sharks, and this is another funny little one, is that they get down into the trench, they see some megalodons, and then a particularly big one swims by, and they go, that must be the apex predator.
Yep.
Which is a very funny, it's a very funny movie trope.
Yeah, that line's funny to me for a couple reasons. Because one, saying the apex predator to a single individual.
Right. That specific shark.
Yes.
Bubba the shark. That's the apex predator.
That's very funny because that when we use the term apex predator in biology, we mean the largest predator in an ecosystem that is not typically preyed upon by any other predators.
Right. And we mean the species.
The species, like, yeah.
Tigers.
Grizzly bears.
Orcas.
Are not going to be preyed upon by basically anyone else, minus some rare occasions.
Right. We don't mean the specific biggest individual.
Yeah, the heaviest crocodile.
That's the ape. Well, it felt like they were, what they wanted to say was alpha.
And that was the other reason it's funny to me.
Yes.
That was exactly the other reasons, is it feels like, and I've seen this in other movies where it feels like they've used those terms interchangeably.
Yeah.
And it feels like at some point either that's gotten conflated or it just, one film did it and other films have used it. I don't know which, but I feel like I've seen that before where they've said, oh, that's the apex. It's like, no, that's, you would have been wrong had you used alpha.
Sure.
Because that's also not how that works.
Also a movie trope.
But that's not the word I think you wanted to use.
Yeah, they're kind of conflating that concept a little bit, which is interesting.
Especially because they then have this big Meg lead the other two as a trio
in the
hunting Megs.
Flying V.
Yeah, like they start, they make a point to be like, no, they're supposed to be solitary, and then they stay together as a group the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
So like, it feels like they wanted it to be the alpha Meg.
Both. They were kind of leaning into that alpha, which again, are all very monstery tropes.
Like
these are very, they work really well in movies because they are shorthand. It allows you to shortcut your way to monstery traits.
Yep.
That's the alpha or the apex predator is movie shorthand for being able to, oh, cool. Now that can be as aggressive and dangerous and giant and as we want it to
We
be.
Mean heavyweight. That's what we mean.
We mean the bad one.
Yes.
We mean the dangerous bad one, and it has to be destroyed.
Yep. Yeah. It's very weird because it's some of the things they did with the Megs are shark tropes, but then like the alpha thing is, that's not a shark thing.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen it that brought up in the context of sharks. In
not really. I'm sure there might be an example I'm missing somewhere in the many, many, many shark movies that have happened.
Dear listeners, let us know if you know a shark movie that calls one the alpha.
But like, yeah, that's a, you added in a different animal monsterification thing.
Yeah, you brought another trope in.
Yeah, a mammal thing that's typically used on stuff like that and used it on the sharks, which is weird.
Yeah. So the Megs themselves, they're not any better in terms of portrayal than the first movie. On the shark spectrum scale of like how good a job did you do with sharks from 1 to 10, I like a 2.
Yeah.
You get points for mating and training, I guess. But no, these are hitting all the general shark portrayal. This is a movie that is not going to improve anyone's opinions of sharks.
No.
Or pull people away from old negative ideas about sharks.
Yeah,
this is fully entrenched in classic shark misconceptions.
They don't even have any character that's trying to counteract it. All the characters are constantly like, oh great, Megs.
Right.
Ugh. Like we could use more of those.
Yes, this is just what we needed. They're all terrified of them the whole time. The one person who seems to a little bit be empathizing with one single one of the sharks.
That he has a specific bond with.
I have a specific... Everyone else treats him like he's crazy.
Well, and he is at no point like, no, we shouldn't kill any of them.
No.
He's 100% on board with the grenade harpoons.
Yes.
The whole time. Yeah. He defends them. Yes. When another person's like, seems like a bad idea. He's like, do you have a better one? We've got to blow these sharks up.
Yes.
And then only when it's his good shark left does he go, wait. Yeah. I can fix this one.
This one's okay.
And now that it's the only one left.
No one else is on board with that.
No.
It's like, this movie is very anti-shark.
Yeah.
It is pro-monster, like that the it's supposed to be fun, monstery stuff. But in terms of shark representation, this is bad shark representation.
Extremely.
It's interesting because we're talking about the ways that this movie is pulling tropes and concepts from other movies, the ways that sharks are portrayed. And it makes me wonder if those little kind of nice things, the training and that stuff, I'd love to say that is maybe the influence of more understanding and appreciation of sharks, but I wonder if it's not the influence of Jurassic World.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You kept the shark in a place, you're training it with a clicker.
Yeah.
You're trying to form a little bond with it. This movie very much has that sort of feeling to it.
Is it just Blue the shark?
Yeah, is that this is also now a trope you put in a monster movie?
That's very fair. If that is the case, that would knock its scoring down slightly.
There are other creatures in the movie. Two other types of creatures make it out of the trench when the Megs go up. The second one is these amphibious things.
Yep.
So in the beginning of the movie, there's a scene that takes place in the Cretaceous period. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But it introduces these... They're kind of... They have that sort of crocodilla morph look to them. They look kind of like prehistoric amphibians, but they're crawling around rapidly.
Oh, like, they've got legs under the body and are running around like a terrestrial croc or a dinosaur cousin.
Yes. They also have like theropod faces.
Yes, they do.
Sort of tall faces, but then their tails are flat for swimming. And I think their fingers are webbed.
Yeah, and I
think.
In one scene I was able to see that I think they were supposed to have had gills of some sort.
Oh, interesting.
And they're shown to be good swimmers.
Yes.
In that scene
I guess they have to have gills.
Yeah.
So those are also down in the trench and they attack people while they're in the trench and then they come back up onto water. They are extremely fast at swimming and extremely adept on land. These are, in terms of sort of prehistoric animal representation, fully made up.
Yep. These are completely fictional movie monsters.
They aren't given a name in the movie. To the movie's credit, I don't think it even calls them dinosaurs.
Nope.
Points for that, I guess. These are fully made up, and they are also fully movie monsters.
Yes. They come on to land, immediately just start murdering people.
Just going after everything that they can get their teeth on.
I don't even think we see them eating anyone. Like, there's not even a scene where they, like, over them eating a body. They kill and then seemingly
move on to the next one.
Because we don't see, like, eaten bodies. They're just dead bodies.
They also do the other common monster thing where they've just got teeth like a... I don't even have the pointy teeth sticking out of the mouth, crossing over each other in that way that most animals don't have teeth like that.
Yep.
I guess if they're hunting fish, those teeth make a little more sense.
Yeah. But we only see them go after big meaty prey.
Yes, on land.
Like, we only see... And, like, the closest they come to hunting anything underwater are people.
Yes. That's
true. So, like, we see them eating a carcass, and we see them attacking people. We don't see them catching fish. And so those teeth could make sense, but they do very much feel like... They're like Venom teeth, like from Venom the comic book character. They're just big, scary, sharp teeth.
They also, in addition to being monstery, fit this trope that is a common... This comes up sometimes in movies, that this undersea area is this lost world trope where not only have megalodons survived down there, but these amphibious, crocky creatures have also survived down there for, according to the movie, 65 million years.
Minimum.
And they've been there and are exactly the same as they were in our late Cretaceous scene that we got at the start of the movie.
Yep.
So that's this lost world living fossil sort of movie trope of these have just been down here unchanged that whole time.
Yes. And that's one of the biggest issues you have whenever it's the like, oh, it turns out dinosaurs survived on this one island or at the Earth's core or wherever your movie decided to place dinosaurs or prehistoric creatures. And it's like, cool. They would continue like to change during that whole time. That place, wherever you're putting them, isn't like where they were living.
Right. Though yeah, movies will often treat them like a time capsule.
Yes.
And that's what in that lost world trope, you'll often see that. This is doing that same sort of thing, which is extra silly, I think, in this case, because the implication is that these creatures have been underwater for 65 million years. But given the chance, they are still perfectly adept at running around and hunting on land.
Yep.
Which is a very funny implication in this movie.
Yeah, well, and underwater at the bottom of the sea.
Yeah.
So, like, not way only...
25,000 feet, according to the movie.
Not only living underwater, but living in the most extreme part of underwater.
Yes. And they've stuck with their classic body plan.
Well, they're the one of... They plan ahead. They're like, no. Everyone else said I should get rid of these arms and legs.
Jason Statham's going to come down here someday.
I'm going to hold on to them. You all are going to feel silly.
We're going to be ready.
Someday when I have these and I'm ready for them.
Get out there. Listen to those Megs. They're not up on the land, are they? They certainly aren't. And then there's also a giant octopus.
Yeah, there's just... and, like, there was some... I can't remember if it was a squid or octopus or nautiloid of some sort in the first one that attacks one of their subs and, like, starts to crush it. And then it gets eaten by a Meg. And that's the introduction to the Meg is, look, I just killed this other sea monster. But, yeah, a giant octopus makes its way out of the depth and just starts grabbing people.
Yeah. And it is maybe the most monstery thing in the movie because we hardly even see it.
Yes.
It's there to do not even like an animal monster trope, but like a pirate movie trope.
Exactly. Yeah. This is just any giant octopus from a pirate movie.
Tentacles coming up out of the water and grabbing stuff in a way that is very unlike how an actual animal would act.
Yep.
It's here to another animal that we don't actually see eat anything. It's just pulling things down and destroying things.
Which is, on one hand, like, you're not even referencing tropes about this creature, but tropes from other stories that have made up this monster. But also, like, the least interesting thing to do with a giant octopus.
Right.
Like, so you took one of the smartest sea creatures and made it huge and then did nothing with it.
Yep.
Bummer.
This is another one that is, this is a monstery trope. They made it gigantic, just like they did with the Megs. They made it all about going after, not only going after food, but going after people.
Yes.
These animals, the suggestion in the movie is that they come up out of the trench and then travel, I think it's like 70 kilometers.
Yeah.
Directly to the nearest island where there are people on there.
And like, that's funny for a number of reasons, because the people head there because they're stuck in the middle of the ocean.
Right. Well, and what's the nearest place with human
that
with
will have a radio that we can radio in?
Yes. And we can warn people, yes. Say, hey, by the way, there's monsters around.
But then the movie shifts very quickly when it's like, yeah, and that's also where the monsters are going.
Immediately. They get there before the main characters get there.
And they somehow all knew that's where they should go.
All of them went there. Well, that's where there's no food in the ocean.
No, what?
They had to go to the near island and get all the way the food is.
They all think fish smells weird.
Listen, we've been eating fish for 65 million years. We went down in the trench. We're in the mood for something new.
Like, the only indication we get that they would eat anything else is that when the last Meg doesn't eat them, it follows some dolphins out to sea, and they're like, it's chasing the dolphins.
Yes.
So, okay, I guess they'd be willing to eat dolphins.
On the note of movie tropes, there is also the shark and the octopus fight.
Yes.
There's a fight. There's a giant shark versus mega octopus, or mega shark versus giant octopus. That fight happens.
Yeah.
Very briefly in the movie.
That there's a moment when the giant octopus is attacking a person, and then even though these two animals have been in the same part of the water this entire portion of the movie, swimming around each other,
and also lived in the same part of the trench for their entire lives,
at this moment the shark goes, you,
this one, well, it's in feeding frenzy attack mode.
Yeah. And
now
they
it's time to eat.
Must kill each other.
So all of this to say, all of these animals are just monsters. They're very much leaning into the monster-y tropes and movie tropes.
Yep.
Pulling on other movie tropes as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
There are also a bunch of other creatures in this movie that we don't get highlighted very much, but they show up in two particular scenes. The first is this flashback to the... Speaking of Jurassic World things that they've pulled up, there is this brief scene in the beginning of the movie that says Cretaceous period, 65 million years ago. And it just is a very quick scene that has a little dragonfly that I think it eats something,
yeah,
right?
It catches something in midair and eats
catches
it.
A little bug, then gets eaten by a lizard, which then gets eaten by one of these amphibian things, which then runs over and fights some other amphibian things around a carcass, and then a T-Rex comes out of the forest and eats some of these guys, and then a megalodon emerges out of the sea and eats the T-Rex.
Yep.
It manages to, in about 2 minutes, do as many of the prehistoric time period tropes as it possibly can do.
Yep.
It's doing the savage world where everything is killing everything all the time.
Eat or be eaten.
It's mixing and matching time periods. Megalodon did not cross over with Tyrannosaurus. I'm going to assume that those dragonflies are supposed to be gigantic.
Yep.
Because they always are. And it has, this is my favorite part, is the T-Rex roaring like a monster.
Mm-hmm.
Undeterred by being in the water.
Yeah, yeah. It roars underwater at the amphibians that swim away.
Yeah, and they all go swimming away. And it starts roaring, sticks its head in the water and continues to roar, and then pulls its head back up out of the water, still roaring.
Yep.
It's very ancient world full of monsters.
Yeah.
Kind of scene.
And it's the purpose being to show that the Meg was the top of the food chain.
Yes.
But like, yeah, Meg did not. If I have my dates right, I think Meg is 20 to, is it 5? I think was the most recent. Yeah.
Meg goes extinct around 3 million.
Yeah, that's what I couldn't remember if it was 5 or 3 that it got adjusted to.
And shows that, yeah, 20, 25 million, yep. I think. So way after the Cretaceous ends.
A fairly recent prehistoric creature. Like, much more recent than most of your other big, crazy sea monster type fossil organisms. Never would have been able to hunt a dinosaur, regardless of the fact that they would have been on the beach.
Yes.
and that's not how sharks hunt.
Yeah, it comes right up. Well, which again is part of that monsterification of these sharks. It will go after anything, anywhere, no matter how unreasonable it is.
Yeah, even if it would surely beach itself getting to that food.
Yes.
Yeah, it's very silly and just the hyper aggression that every single thing that's not a, well, even a lot of the humans, there's tons of examples where the humans, regardless of the fact that the protagonist is being chased by a giant shark, is like, now we need to get in there to kill him.
Right, because it's an action scene.
Because it's an action, even though the giant shark that is not on your side is right there. Like, even the humans are like monstery and just, I must kill, I have my target in my sight. Every organism in this movie, minus the dolphins,
yes,
is hyper aggressive.
And that dog.
And there's that dog. That dog.
Then that one dog. So we get this brief Cretaceous scene. There's also the trench.
Yes.
They go down under the water, and then there's this sequence where they're wandering across the trench, encountering a bunch of life in that area, which, of course, everything is scary.
Yep.
There's a lamprey.
Yeah, a giant lamprey.
Like a giant lamprey.
Grabs onto one of their helmets and is a jump scare.
And wraps around, like...
Yeah, constrictors his head.
Constrictors around the head. There's a bunch of scary fish. That scene does have a bunch of, like, cool bioluminescent... They look like plants, but, you know.
Yeah, like
benefit of the doubt, these are...
Coral garden or anemone-type things.
Yeah.
Which is a nice... That is a deep sea feature of a lot of life, is that they have bioluminescence and glow.
Yep.
But it is the way they portrayed the bottom of the deepest part of our planet was extremely lush.
Yeah, it was very diverse And it very much gives the feeling of like an alien landscape mm-hmm. that they're wandering across, and there's dangers everywhere. It feels like a traveling in an alien planet kind of scene in a movie.
Oh, absolutely.
Where everything is potentially where everything is either beautiful or dangerous.
Yes.
Or both.
One of the big things, though, that stood out to me was just that, like, the suggestion that there's that many things alive that close together at the bottom of the sea.
Yeah.
Like, the bottom of the sea is a desert. And more barren than our deserts up here are, because there's nothing's growing with photosynthesis down there.
Mm-hmm.
The only way you get food is if it's bubbling up from the Earth's crust, or if something dies and falls down there.
Yeah.
That's it.
They're also there. They did show some vents.
Yes, they did.
Which does have that feeling of, much like in the prehistoric scene where they're piling a bunch of prehistoric stuff together, this trench scene had a bit of the feeling of, we're putting in a bunch of deep sea stuff.
Yes.
We're going to put in pretty bioluminescent stuff. We're going to put in scary fish. We're going to put in vents. Like, here, let's pile on a bunch of deep sea tropes. Essentially, these are real things, but they are sort of the expected features of a deep sea environment.
Yeah, it's the entire deep sea in a square mile.
Yes.
And so, yeah, it's very stereotypical in a lot of ways, and then also has that prehistoric world thing going, that the whole idea is the thermocline, that layer of cold water is what's trapping all those things down. They would die if they went through this hyper cold layer of saline water. So that, I guess, just formed and trapped everything that was that's suggesting that was the environment back then, and then it got trapped down there. But none of them have been affected by being cut off from the rest of the ocean and are just fine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's like if we locked you in your room away from your kitchen, you just stay there.
Right. It's got that, it's that lost world trope
yeah.
of everything's sort of in stasis.
Yep.
Sort of just sticking around. If you go down here, you're effectively traveling back in time where all these ancient things are.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of creature stuff. There's a surprising amount of creature stuff for us to talk about. I was worried going into this movie that there's going to be some big sharks and we're going to say all the same stuff as we did for the first episode where we talked about the Meg.
But in a typical sequel fashion, they had to add more bad guys.
Yeah. So they put, there's a bunch. So yeah, the animals and the environments in this movie are very much leaning on these monstery tropes, these savage prehistoric landscape kind of tropes. And that's really what characterizes all of them. So this is very much in that same bucket as all those other things.
Yeah.
Outside of that, there's not a ton more science-y stuff. There is some science methods.
Yes.
That we see here. We do see some kind of science or science adjacent stuff being shown on screen. The main characters are going on expeditions down to the deep part of the ocean. They have these submersibles and they go down to the bottom to explore and investigate what's going on down there.
And they're like mapping out different quadrants as they go.
And I do like that implication. That's clearly drawing on real world deep dive expeditions down to trenches and things like that, where you have special submersibles and teams of people going down to survey and take data and bring special equipment.
And that we're going down to a specific spot next to where we looked last time, and we're going to do a search of this area.
Yeah.
Or, next to a specific feature that we are curious about. And so it does have a bit of that standardized research feel to it.
Yeah, it feels like it is sort of grounded in these real-world methodologies of how you go and explore something that is difficult to access, with the added weirdness of, they go through the thermocline and this sort of made-up section of it. And then, of course, since this is an action movie, they immediately go off mission and start doing a bunch of ridiculous things and getting into trouble with monsters and stuff.
Yes. The protocol is a suggestion.
Yes. So these are not good scientists in the movie. They are, like, on paper, they've got all the good science instructions, but then they go have an action movie.
Well, and it's got that weird contradiction that happens a lot in these kinds of movies where most of the people that we follow for the rest of the movie are part of a research team mapping out and documenting the trench below the thermocline and all the life that's down there.
Yes.
Like they're part of an Oceania organization that's trying to document the sea. And then they are the also the ones who immediately go, we got to kill these Megs that have just gotten out.
Yes. Like, and also half of them are action ready heroes.
Yep. Who better to have on your field expeditions than a bunch of mercenaries?
Yes. Well, and it has a bit of that sort of Jurassic Park feel of here's your whole research team running this whole operation. But the team is largely made up of like people with guns or a handful of specific people with specific jobs. It's not a very robust team of people.
Movies that do that with the teams on stuff all the time. I get why you did that. You're going to have action scenes later.
Yeah.
You need some action people. But the fact that the employer of your fake company in this movie hired a bunch of action movie people makes it feel like they also were expecting there to be action scenes later.
Well, and that is absolutely something that this movie leans in. And this is part of that monsterizing these animals, is that your research vessel goes down there with guns.
Yes.
And as soon as they see the sharks, they're like, all right, prepare the anti-predator tools on the ship.
Which, you know, I thought was a neat concept of you have a way to make your ship not tasty to these predators that you are now researching next to.
Right.
Like, that happens in real world where it's like, all right, we have to have countermeasures because we're researching where polar bears are. Mm-hmm. So, like, put bars on the windows of the research building and make sure the door locks, not just closes, when we have bears around.
Yes. This movie starts with that, like, yeah, it's the research vessel, it's exploration, but then adds that layer of, we're going to a place where everything is going to try to kill us.
Yes.
Which is very much the leaning into that movie trope of monsters and prehistoric primal stuff.
Well, it's got the whole Ian Malcolm thing from Lost World, the second movie, where he's like, to every person he meets, it's like, this is the only place where, you know, the wild gooses chase you, and it's putting you in nice biting position. It's that every single thing is just, you're dooming yourself to death if you're there.
Yes. It's an interesting perspective, because in this movie, not only does the movie treat all of the creatures like they are dangerous monsters they're going to attack at any moment, but all the characters treat them that way too. That is like, and it is established in the movie that they have been exploring this place and coming to understand these creatures more and more, and that is the conclusions that they've drawn.
Yeah.
This is how these animals act.
This is how you must deal with these animals.
Yes.
Yep.
I also noticed they did a little bit of that science trope in movies that they do sometimes, where the characters will speak with authority on profound insights into the behavior of the animals.
Yes.
There was a couple of moments of this, and I can't remember specifically what they were in this moment, but they go down to the trench and they're like, there's the Meg. Here's something about what it's doing at this moment.
Yes.
And it has a little bit of that scientific authority feeling of making
declarations,
confident declarations about these strange new creatures to you.
And behaviors you've seen for the first time ever.
Yeah.
Which
is another trope that movies do when they want to explain. Here, so the audience knows this character has explained this and that is true.
And this character is a scientist, so what they say is true.
Right.
Truth only exits their mouth. they speak only truth.
Which is a common trope, not only in movies, but you'll this comes up, I think. It is a common expectation that people can sometimes get caught on that animal behaviors fit in neat little categories of reasons.
Yes.
Like if it, again, this is like you said, that video game portrayal of animals. If it does X, that is because of this. And if it does Y, that is because of this. And if it does Z, that's because of this.
Yes.
Treating them as very simple, straightforward, primitive, almost machine-like, because it's simpler for a movie especially, but a movie that wants to portray them as simple-minded creatures.
And I feel like some of that probably comes from, like, pets that you get to know well enough, and you have that moment of, like, oh, what are they doing? That they probably need to go to the bathroom. That's what they do when they need to go to the bathroom.
Right.
And that, you know, we get so used to knowing these animals that we live with, and I wouldn't be surprised if it comes from there. Though that also is always the example I want to point to when people have that, like, yeah, but shouldn't we know how that, don't you know how that animal behaves, like what it means? Like, how often has your dog scratched at the door, you've put the leash on, taken them out, and they don't go to the bathroom? And you go, what are you doing? Everyone has that with their pets constantly, where you go, why are you doing that? What are you? Stop. What are you doing?
Animal behavior is complex.
Yes.
In ways that are inconvenient for movies, especially this kind of movie that wants to portray them in a certain way.
And inconsistent. Like,
yes.
Your animals have moods too. Something might have them in a weird mood one day and then they never do that again. Like, they are a living organism. They are not a system that is constantly consistent, that is, you know, regularly going to react to everything the same way.
Speaking of captivity, there is also, as we've mentioned already, they keep a shark in captivity, which I thought was an interesting, that's something we don't see very often, particularly with sharks in movies like this. They have an enclosure, kind of. It's like a big batch of water.
Yeah, it's a facility built around part of the sea.
Yes. Where they have one of the megalodons in captivity, and this leans into that training, and this person is trying to create this bond with this shark. And I thought that was an interesting, not only because it does lean a little bit more in the direction maybe of niceness or respect or empathy towards sharks that you don't often see in movies, but also because large sharks are notoriously difficult to keep in captivity in real life.
Yes.
Which is, I think, part of the reason why you might not see that trope very often.
Yeah. No, that is not a thing we can actually do very easily in our real world. Luckily, this is a world that has, like, sci-fi subs that can move as fast as speedboats underwater.
Well, and I also noticed there was at least one moment where they show the shark in that habitat and the water is moving, which made me wonder if, is this meant to be like a conveyor belt for the shark?
I saw it too, and I couldn't tell if that was suggesting that or just a very oddly panning shot.
Yeah.
That made it look like the...
Because it didn't look like that the rest of the time.
No.
It's just a chunk of the sea, like,
and
you said.
If that was just supposed to be it moving by, but the camera followed it in a weird way, and the background didn't pan at the right speed or something. Because I had the exact same thought of like, oh, is this like the water spinning, you know, that you have the water moving through it the shark can be in constant motion without having to travel long distances. That'd be a cool concept.
Yeah.
The other thing that I noted about that scene is they mentioned that they found that shark as a pup and raised it in human care.
Yeah.
Never is anyone like, this is a bad idea. And like, you know, I told you you never should have kept that thing.
It's a typical movie thing.
The only reason things go wrong in this point of the movie is because the movie's happening, but also because, like, now it's breeding season, evidently, and that's why the shark gets all weird. But
yes, now it's breeding season, and there is a conveniently megalodon-shaped tunnel that it manages to break through.
Well, they need a megalodon's worth of water to be moving in and out.
Right, they gotta get it in there. That particular shark is never treated especially monstrous.
No. Like, even the megalodon-hating characters aren't like, you should get rid of that thing.
They should all be destroyed.
Yeah, no, it's never suggested that they've had difficulty caring for it up till now.
Yeah.
Or that, like, you know, well, this is the fifth handler you've lost. It's just, no, it's been perfectly fine until it reached breeding age or whatever it is.
And now it's acting up.
Yes.
It's also implied that it has been useful for research.
Yeah.
Like, and that's a real thing. That's a thing we do in real life as well. Take animals into captivity for a certain amount of time, or sometimes their whole life.
Yeah, especially rescued individuals.
Yes. Which I could see that being something in this case, that did this one get out and you couldn't get it back down there, so you took it into captivity.
Or from the standpoint of this movie of, you can't let that thing, like, if you can't get it back down there.
Right, you can't just let it out into the world.
It needs to be behind the thermocline or behind a wall or dead.
Yes. But yeah, we will bring animals into captivity and study them there and come to understand them. And I do like that implication that, well, it's very hard to study them in their natural habitat because it's 25,000 feet down or whatever.
Yeah, we can only take somewhat regular trips down there, and then we have to be inside a sub.
So this is a research animal that one of the people is trying to form a bond with, presumably for the next movie.
Yes.
When they can ride the motorcycle alongside all the megalodons.
Yeah, right.
But I did think that was an interesting angle on these animals that we don't often see.
Yes, agreed. So there's some interesting concepts in the movie, but not they are greatly outnumbered and outweighed by the tropey silly ones.
Yes.
Another thought I just now had and remembered that I noticed in the movie and then got distracted by, they never answer what happens to all the amphibians. Because they show some of them get, like, caught in a fire and some of them get, but, like, conceivably, there's just a bunch of those out now.
Yeah, well, also one of the megalodons gets out.
Yeah, but, like, that's they kill the other megalodon, so we only have the one that now has a tracker on it.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And it has a track. That's another thing that they do is they have a tracker on it, mm-hmm. which is a thing that is pulled from real life.
But there's, like, a dozen
they're just
predatory amphibians running around. That's just, I guess, part of the ecosystem now.
It is interesting that they have the tracker and the shark, because in real life, when we do that, it's to follow the movements of animals in their habitat.
Yes.
So we have sharks with tracking tags on them, and we can follow their patterns of movement over the course of the year. In this movie, the implication is that they have a tracker on it in case it gets out.
Well, they also mention just briefly, I now remember, that they're also monitoring its, like, heart rate.
Oh, that's true. It is like a medical mm-hmm. device.
And that's when they say, like, it's coming back around and its heart rate is elevated.
Up, yeah. Yep.
It doesn't look like they're slowing down as they're coming toward you.
Yeah.
Like, this looks like an attack run. Get out of the water.
Which is pretty cool. I do like that they lean into... Now, it's all used in service of the monster-y aspects of the shark.
Yeah, so now it can be a light on the radar.
And it also has that Velociraptors in Jurassic World feeling of... This is in captivity, and maybe it's trained, but also it has the sense that at any given moment, this thing could just start eating people and destroying stuff, which is very much like what we see in Jurassic World. So overall, the Meg 2, about as monstery and fast and loose with science portrayal as I kind of expected.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it's
after the first one.
Right in the same, the Venn diagram between this and the first one is a circle.
Yep. So scientific portrayal, it's pulling from some interesting real world things, but overall is prioritizing the action movie and the monster-y stuff.
Yeah. I didn't have any major moments of like oh, wow, you're doing okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, I had moments of like, all right, that was potentially interesting or not as bad as it could have been.
Yeah. Now, as we said before on Silver Screen Science, the goal is to hit some of the general broader subjects in science that are tackled by the movie and not just to nitpick all the specific things that the movie gets wrong scientifically. But nitpicking the specific things that a movie gets wrong scientifically is a lot of fun, and we like to do it also. So at the end of every discussion of a movie, we like to give ourselves the opportunity for mini rants, where we will each pick a thing that just bugged us scientifically about the movie. Will, what's your mini rant for Meg 2 the Trench?
The way they handled deep sea pressure.
Mm.
I found it hilarious, or it drove me crazy the whole time. They have a number of things they do that just portrays deep sea pressure in hilarious ways. One of them is that they have deep sea suits, but their suits are not these protective, pressurized, like spacesuit kind of things that are, you know, keeping the pressure inside the suit at a safe level. They are super muscle suits because they are portraying the idea that thing that's dangerous about the deep sea is that it will crush you because you're not strong enough to hold it up or something.
Mm-hmm.
That, like, you need the musculature to fight against the pressure.
Right. The way that these suits are introduced in the movie as being able to handle the pressure is that the dude's breaking concrete with the suits.
That it makes you super strong. These are just exoskeleton muscle suits like have been in most sci-fi movies for the past 5 years.
Yeah, it's an Iron Man suit.
Exactly. Like, and it's not even an Iron Man suit because it's not enclosing your suit. It's just along the outside of your body.
That's true. Yeah.
It's an exoskeleton. Like Elysium had a whole bunch of them stuff.
Yeah.
Like it's the exoskeleton muscle suits that have become so popular in sci-fi movies because we made a version of it in the real world and they went, cool, that's sci-fi movies for the next 10 years.
That's in all the movies now.
It's one of those. So it's like, it's not even encapsulating their body other than their face. They have fabric over the rest of the body, but it's just fabric. It, like, at best, they made it look like it's supposed to be like maybe Kevlar or some sort of, you know, a carbon fiber weave. They made it look like, they never say that, but it looks like that kind of material. So it's just a very weird interpretation. And you might be saying, well, they put super suits in because it's an action movie, so they can use it later on. They don't. They right. don't use it for any fight scene.
It's just for that.
It's just because the ocean's heavy, I guess.
Going through the water.
So that's
well, you don't see fish wearing armor.
And that's, yeah. And then
that is a line in the movie.
That's a line in the movie. Says, when Jason Statham free dives in the trench, and they say, well, the danger is that any air will be compressed, but water doesn't compress underwater. So if you get water in your sinuses, it won't crush your skull, even though that ignores all the other air spaces in our body and all the other fluids that aren't the same pressure and the two giant lungs that we have that are full of air.
Yes.
So it's just like
He
breathed out.
He breathed out first.
He breathed it all out. Collapsed his lungs.
Yeah, they have the scene, which is the scene from the core, which is you have to go out and do the thing to save everybody, and you have to survive just long enough to get the thing done in this fully unsurvivable environment.
And it's just super weird because they keep explaining the pressure, but then doing things that don't match what they're explaining, don't match what pressure is, and just, it's very weird.
Yes, they fast and loose with the scientific information, and like, as well as
sometimes it will be within a scene that they're like, that won't work because of this, and then they do something that you just said wouldn't work. Very weird.
My mini rant, and I'm going to do this one because we didn't bring it up earlier, the first moment in the movie that made me go, no. What? Happens about 2 minutes into the movie, which is in that Cretaceous scene where the T-Rex is on the shore and it's like ankle deep in the water and it turns around and then the Meg emerges out of the water and grabs the T-Rex. And I was like, there's no way it got that far up shore.
Yeah.
This animal, you've portrayed the Megs as absolutely colossal. 80 feet long. They're enormous. This is in knee-deep water at best.
Yep.
That this animal, most modern sharks couldn't pull that off.
Nope.
This thing just appears out of nowhere, comes up out of the ocean, grabs us, and then presumably goes back into the oceans. There's just sea turtles its way back hundreds of feet down the shallow slope.
Yep.
Which is, of course, another thing that movies like this like to do. There's a lot of sharks jumping out of the water.
Oh, yeah.
In this movie.
Well, I remember when, what was it? The Shallows, where the surfer gets stuck, gets attacked by a great white, and then has to, like, is stuck on this little rock outcrop in view of the shore. But the whole point is safety's within view, but they can't get there because the shark's still around.
Mm-hmm.
But it has a scene where a guy gets taken by the shark with that breaches and grabs him closer to the shore than she is.
Oh, yeah.
In even shallower water.
Yep.
It's like that water could have been like 5 feet deep at most, and that shark got enough run up to fully exit the water.
Fully leap out of the water. Yeah, that's what this shark does.
Yes.
An 80-foot shark leaps out of the water from waist deep.
What we didn't see is that the shark leapt from 200 feet away.
It had a wave.
Yeah.
It got a wave going, and then it rode the wave, and it launched itself like a
tasty
torpedo.
Wave.
A tasty wave right toward that saw it, smelled it. Smelled it from thousands of feet away, and it came right in here. It was like, this is where the T-Rex is going.
Yep.
There's a carcass on land, and all the creatures are eating it. That's going to draw a T-Rex, and I'm going to be there waiting for it.
I've been waiting hours here for a T-Rex to show up.
I killed that creature, and now I've been waiting.
It was like the orcas that put the fish up to be able to grab birds. I tossed that up there.
Yeah, the Megalodon invented that trick and used it on dinosaurs. Orcas are wusses.
My theropods are bigger.
Thank you for listening to Silver Screen Science. This has been a lot of fun. This is our first Silver Screen Science episode of the year. There will be two more following this the next couple of weeks in April, where we will tackle some other sharky thing. Better shark movies.
Yes, I'm very excited.
We're going to do some good ones. It's going to be a lot of fun. Keep your ears out for the upcoming Silver Screen Science episodes in April. Also, if you are interested in hearing more thoughts from us, after each of these episodes, we put a More Thoughts episode on Patreon for our patrons to enjoy, where we set aside all of our science-y analysis and just talk about our personal feelings and experience of watching the movie. We're going to record that right now once we finish doing this. So check that out on Patreon if you are a patron. And if you're not, there's More Thoughts on there. Maybe consider joining us. And Don't forget that in May, on May 5th, we will be having a Silver Screen Science live stream for anybody to join, and we'll chat about science and sharks and these movies that we've been talking about. It should be a lot of fun. Also, since it's 2024, I'll mention that Spotlight 2024 is coming out over the course of this year, where we're interviewing our fellow science communicators and podcasters about science communication and podcasting. We got a lot of stuff coming out that's going on around now, so check it all out. That's Meg 2, The Trench. Now we're done talking about these movies forever until, yep, you know, inevitably there's a third one. Yep. And we'll see how we feel about it. I expected to not have very much to talk about with this movie. So yep. I was pleasantly surprised that this made for interesting silver screen discussion.
They're going to go back in time and fight Megs at the source.
At the source, when they were even bigger.
Yep.
Because everything obviously was bigger. These Megs are 150 Megs. Feet. The saber-toothed Megs.
Saber-toothed woolly Megs.
Saber-toothed woolly Megs with feather mohawks. spikes all over them. They look like Mega Sharpedo. Spikes and goatees and stuff. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Common Descent Podcast. You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and check our WordPress blog for pictures and links after each episode. Huge thanks to our patrons, whose support helps keep this podcast running and who get access to bonus goodies on Patreon. The song you're hearing is called On the Origin of Species by Protodome, which we found at ocremix.org. Thanks again for listening. We hope you'll join us next time.